because the engineers and the software writers are listening and paying attention, then the animators feel like they're bringing something that they don't know about. And so you end up in a place where neither side knew at the beginning.
You're listening to Paint and Pipette. I'm your host, Jeremy Utley. I teach innovation and entrepreneurship at Stanford University. Thanks for joining me to explore the art and science of bringing new ideas to life. Let's dive in. The creative genius behind Pixar, Ed Catmull himself, is going to teach us how to make magic. Ed not only pioneered the field of computer animation, he also led Pixar through its wildly creative peak. He says every great film sucks at some point. Fixing problems separates duds from brilliant films, and through a detailed case study, he reveals Pixar's secret for brutally honest feedback. Ed offers profound lessons on managing creative teams, invisible barriers, and so much more, but I'll let the master reveal his own secrets. Let's take notes while he pulls back the curtain. I am delighted to introduce a man who needs no introduction, Ed Catmull, founder, former CEO of Pixar, former CEO of Disney Animation Studios. Ed, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure to be with you.
I've been so looking forward to this conversation. And I've kind of crowdsourced questions from a bunch of the designers and executives in my network. And I'm really eager to share them with you. If they're great questions, I don't get credit. But if it doesn't go well, I take full responsibility. But I know we have a ton to cover. And so I just want to dive straight in. So with your permission, I thought it'd be really fun to zoom into one particular moment in 2014 that you write about in your book. It's called the Zootopia incident, you could say. And I thought it'd be fun to use this story as a way to get to the heart of your management values. So would you tell us a little bit about this kind of this mid-production screening, so to speak, where the Disney team brought Zootopia to the Pixar team, and bring us into their thought process in that moment? Why are they bringing the film to the team at this moment?
Well, they are bringing it because they know that the team at Pixar wants to help them and can. So the background for that is that for many years, as we were developing Disney, the rule was that we were keeping the studios very separate from each other because we needed Disney to have its own strong culture at every level. So this worked great. But now that they had reached that kind of level, we still had a problem with every film. And that is, you get lost in each film, like every film.
Okay.
There's always something that goes seriously wrong. A hard thing for people to understand, but these babies are not born without pain. And the first time we tried this was the film before Pixar, which was Inside Out, because Inside Out had some problems where we were stuck. So it was the first one where we said, okay, let's show it down at Disney for their brain trust. They call it the story trust.
Okay.
And they were able to tease out the issues that helped raise it to the high level that it got to.
Okay.
Because Pete Docter was able to see things he couldn't see before. Since that was successful, when we got to Zootopia down at Disney.
I can't imagine, as a Zootopia aficionado, okay, it's probably my favorite Disney film, I can't imagine there being a problem with it, right? So I'm already kind of struggling to even wrap my mind around this, because to me, it's such an incredible film. I can't imagine it needing intervention at any time.
Yes, and the original film, the fox, Nick, was the main character, and Hops is like secondary to him, with always the two of them. But Nick's journey was to go from a cynical person to one that sort of opened up from that. And it was a world in which there were predators, which you saw, but in order to keep the predators in line, they wore these collars, which would shock them if they got too far out of line.
Okay. To my knowledge, that's not a part of the film that I saw, right? So that's an interesting kind of plot twist I didn't know about. But where is the team's head at? It sounds like the Disney team brings the film to the Pixar team because they know there's some kind of challenge. Where's their head at? What's the timeline they're dealing with? What's the challenge they're trying to solve? Why did they shine the bat signal in the sky at this point?
Well, the thing to know in general is that the filmmakers know they have problems. They're not deluded on any film. in general, they're not deluded.
Good clarification.
Sometimes they are. And so if you get deluded or you get caught up in something and you fall in love with something that isn't working, that's when you need some outside force to come in and gently hit you across the forehead with the 2x4.
Very gently.
And because you know that the person that's doing this wants you to succeed. So in this case, they knew there was a problem. They thought, well, since it worked when we gave notes to Pixar, maybe it would work if we showed the film. When Pixar gave the notes, it's confusing.
I got you. I'm tracking with you. Okay. Did we realize we're able to help Pixar? Maybe they could help us now.
That's right.
Right. Okay.
They came up and they showed the film. So what? And the way this works is we have a screening. We also have other people in the studio see it because you kind of need an audience. It affects how you perceive what you're seeing. Then we'd have the Brain Trust and then that group that was in charge of Zootopia with the Pixar Brain Trust. And we're giving the notes for it. And for the first 15 or 20 minutes, Andrew didn't say anything. And as I mentioned, there were callers on the other predators.
Who's Andrew, by the way? You said Andrew didn't mention anything.
Andrew Stanton.
Okay.
I mean, at Pixar, he's just Andrew.
Everybody knows Andrew. Yeah, exactly. We all know Andrew here. We're all among friends. Okay. So Andrew Stanton from Pixar, famed, legendary producer, thought leader. He's sitting there and he's sitting silently is what you're saying.
Yes. Andrew's the one who did WALL-E. He did Finding Nemo. And he's brilliant at structure and emotion. And he's highly respected by the people at Pixar. So that when he does talk, he's to the point. I mean, he's very thoughtful about what he does, but he also takes the time to think it through. So about 20 minutes in, he said, when I got into Zootopia and I see this world and the callers and the whole premise of it, I can never like this city. I can never want to go to this city. This is unforgivable.
So he drops a bombshell. I mean, a word like unforgivable from Andrew Stanton is not like, okay, next comment. It's where do you go from there?
That's right. So essentially, his notion is it needed a bombshell so that when they returned, because he wasn't telling them how to solve the problem, he was just saying, this is unforgivable. It absolutely doesn't work. So when they return, they're pretty shaken and they have to figure out what it is because he wanted them to rethink how this was going to work.
Yeah.
Now, the interesting thing was that there were already people at Disney who had said this doesn't work. That is, the comments that they heard from Pixar were comments that they had heard within the group before.
Okay.
There weren't new ideas.
Okay.
But they had some things in the making of the film that they fell in love with. There was one scene in particular where when the child reaches a certain age, they get their collar. And it's treated as if it's a coming of age thing, but you know that it's actually not good. And the adult polar bears who are putting this around their child also know this isn't good, but it's part of what it means to join an adult society.
So you said there's a beloved scene. It sounds like the team, maybe the team's holding on to, or they just feel like really works. What does it take to have, if you just take that scene, how much effort, thought, investment has been placed into that scene, which sounds like maybe it's part of the problem. Maybe it's part of the unforgivable part of the society. What is contributing to the Disney team's reluctance to embrace the feedback it sounds like they were getting?
Well, it's a very emotional scene. It's setting the emotional core for the film. And because it was a tentpole for the film that was far along in the production and they were putting more energy into it. So this would be the classic case of falling in love with your darlings. Mm. And then someone comes along and says, I'm sorry, you got to kill that. It's getting in the way of the rest of your movie. So the thing that you've invested in heavily is actually ruining what you were doing. And it's hard for them to let go of it. And so it took someone on the outside who was very respected to just say, this is not working.
And why, when you say it took somebody on the outside, like Andrew, it sounds like they got a little bit of this feedback even from inside Disney. What was it? Why couldn't they see it when they were at Disney? Can you speak for a moment to the value of an outsider like Andrew?
Well, it was something we learned early on, is that the people who are close to it all get kind of used to it, and they may end up falling in love with it too.
Right.
So what does it mean to have objectivity if you've been involved in the process all along? And the origin of the brain trust was actually to try to solve this problem. Because with our first films, like
the objectivity problem, just to be clear.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
When we were starting with A Toy Story and Bug's Life, we had someone who did that. It was Tom Schumacher down at Disney.
Okay.
And it was great because he was on the outside and he wanted us to succeed and he gave good notes. But he was actually moved to New York to be over with their theatrical group, their musicals. And Disney started to decline at that time in the quality of its films. And so we knew we were going to have a problem. So the Brain Trust was formed in order to be an outside group.
In order to kind of fill Tom's shoes, so to speak. So this mechanism has been developed to provide objective perspective to folks who are in danger of falling in love with potentially problematic storylines or problematic issues.
Yes. Now, the problem was that didn't work.
Okay. Say more.
Okay. So it turns out because they were involved in the making of the film, they really weren't an objective outside force.
No. Even the brain trust itself, you mean, starts to lose its objectivity. Wow.
Yes. So the interesting thing to me was it was formed for one purpose and it didn't work at that purpose. But we discovered in the process that it was incredibly valuable in giving help and notes to each other. Mm. We ended up with a brain trust as a really potent tool, but we still need an outside force.
Hence inviting Andrew or others to those moments.
Yeah. So Andrew could be that for Disney or the Brain Trust, excuse me, because there were other great notes that came out of that session from Pixar for other people. It's always several people who do something.
Sure.
But only a few people have that amazing ability to sort of completely break through. We had to get something else at Pixar. And it turns out that was Steve Jobs. But because he could be an outside force and you can't ignore him. And he wanted us to succeed. So for us, it was like figuring out, what are these pieces? How do you get the objectivity on the outside that's going to work? But also, how do you have the problem on the inside? Brain Trust proved out to be one of our most potent tools for solving problems.
I want to drill into one part of the Brain Trust because I think it's fascinating. You talk about one of the roles you emphasize is somewhat, in my world, we'd say it's meta, meaning it's kind of like it's another layer of abstraction beyond. But I wanted to talk about the person whose job it is to be mindful of the group dynamic itself, because you talk about a commitment to improving the mechanism. So what I'm curious is, this person who's attending to the group dynamic, what are they looking for in a brain trust meeting? How are they assessing what are the signs of health or the signs of dysfunction that they're actually looking for in trying to improve the group dynamic?
You can look at it in two parts. One of them is the group itself is aware of the meta dynamics that are there. So they will sometimes say, oh, this didn't work well. I would also say at Pixar, because it was really Jim Morris and I who were part of all these meetings, but we weren't really the note givers for it.
You could attend to the dynamic yourself, you're saying.
Yes.
Yeah.
So while it's fun to give notes, the trick is not to get lost in doing that. It's actually to look at how well is the group working? Is somebody holding back? Is somebody overdoing it? Are people not listening? That's what we're looking at.
How do you know if someone's, just for example, I love that. How do you know if someone's holding back? What behavior or body language are you looking for? Let's kind of call it the keeper of the context of the brain trust. How do you know if you go, hey, Andrew hasn't spoken up in a while, or what are you looking for there?
Well, the first thing to note is I can't read minds. All I can do is look at body language and their behavior and their performance. All right. So if I see some clues in terms of the way they're talking or the way others are reacting to them, I can follow up afterwards to find out whether or not the clues are correct.
And is that in the moment or you actually circle back later, like, you know, the next day? Later. Okay. I noticed yesterday What was going on there? You'd actually reference a meeting.
Yeah, I just go in and ask them about things, or I'll talk with others because other people are aware of the meta issues that are there, but that isn't their main job. My main job is to look at the meta issues. Theirs is to look at the story.
Right.
But I have to say that over several years, they do learn about how this works. They've also grown to trust each other. And in general, the process works very well. But there are times when it goes off the rails, when somebody tries to exert too much authority, or they don't listen, or there are things like that that go wrong.
Hmm.
And on the other side, every once in a while, just magic happens. Typically at least once per film. And by magic, I mean that the ego has left the room.
Yeah.
When I say ego has left the room, it's that people can put out an idea, and if it works, they don't feel all puffed up or like, oh, thank goodness I said something that worked and the others lied.
Right.
If it doesn't work, they feel deflated because they become attached to what they're doing and they feel judged by what they said.
So just to make sure I'm understanding, when ego leaves the room, one of the evidences that ego leaves the room is there's a lack of a sense of ownership or a detachment between an individual and the ideas they're contributing. And that could be, they're not like a dog on a bone insisting on their way, but they're also not, they don't get discouraged if somebody moves on. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Well, another way of saying it is they're trying to solve the problem for the film.
Yeah.
So the only thing they care about is whether or not it's working for the film.
Mm.
And if they throw out an idea and it helps the film, good. If it doesn't, that's okay too, because the focus is on getting the problem solved for the film.
Yeah.
And if everybody gets into that state, then you find that the nature of it changes and the nature of the discussion changes, all of which is around getting the film moving in the right direction, which also includes you start going down a path and you say, okay, this path isn't working. Then the whole group would go back and sort of reset and go in a different direction.
Hmm.
And by saying people aren't attached to it, it's like, when you pull back and go a different direction, people don't feel deflated. It's like, okay, they're in agreement. Let's try something.
You know, the picture I got in my mind is almost like either kids playing soccer or something, like they're all, or a school of fish. There's this sense of we can all, let's all move in this direction. Let's all move over here. It's not somebody going, no, but I want to be over here. There's a fluidity to the movement of the group.
Yes.
Yeah. We're talking about film. And I know you've mentioned actually, especially in the expanded edition of the book, which I love, by the way, it gave me a whole new opportunity to read the book. So I loved reading it with fresh eyes. One of the things you mentioned is that Brain Trust has kind of taken on a life of its own, right? And one thing I would love to know is, what about outside of film? And specifically, for example, I was talking with a CEO friend of mine, Bracken Darrell, who's the CEO of VF Corporation, formerly at Logitech. And he told me he actually loves the Brain Trust and he's tried to implement it and emulate it, but he said he never caught it quite right. And one of the things he asked me, and that I would love to kind of dig in, or he asked me to ask you, is how do you incorporate customer feedback into the Brain Trust? Because at least in the book, there's a lot of team feedback. Is there a role for the customer voice or the customer perspective? Or how do you think about that, especially in areas maybe that aren't so, I don't know if specialized as film is the right word, or where customer feedback drives a lot of the kind of product development process?
Well, I mean, first of all, it's one of the issues for us is we only get really one chance at audience feedback, which comes late in the game. But I believe strongly that getting the feedback from the customers or the people who use them is an integral part of the creative process. So, and let's say from a software point of view, is we do write a lot of software where our customers are the people in the company, like the animation group.
Right. The engineer is the customer there. Yeah.
So if you think about it, the people who are writing the software for the animators are not animators. Okay. So they can watch them and they can make a guess as to what's needed, but they don't really know. The animators are asking for certain features, but they don't really know what's possible.
Right, right.
So if they ask something early on and we give them what they want, by the time they get it, they'll say, well, that isn't quite what I meant, or, oh, you can do more? So this then becomes this process where the user is bringing something to the table here.
Right.
And the engineers value what they bring. Because the engineers and the software writers are listening and paying attention, then the animators feel like they're bringing something that they don't know about. And so you end up in a place where neither side knew at the beginning.
Right. It's a reciprocal surprise process almost.
Yeah. And when it comes to getting the customer feedback, frankly, for us, it's a little bit easier because they're in the same building.
Yeah. That makes sense. Maybe we could even use software or animators tools as an example of this. I know that when you're doing a brain trust for a film, you screen the film, right? Which to me is kind of a metaphor in a way for a picture of enabling a team to immerse itself in each other's works in progress. And so you screen a film and you're immersed in the work in progress. What are other ways that folks outside of film, and maybe you could talk about animators and technology, you know, someone's running a consumer goods company or a technology company, what are kind of analogs for immersing yourself in the work of others in order to have a productive brain trust where you have the objectivity required to address a problem?
Well, for me, one of the first things is you really have to value and appreciate what the users or the potential users have and recognize that they often want things that we don't know about. So we can never take a process of where we know what they want. It's more like our values come from the fact that we understand we're going to try to learn from them. And if we value them, we're more likely to adapt to what they need. So there really is that reciprocal part of anything that's going to develop and get better. And you have to start from that. Okay. Now, if we agree that's a thing, how do we do it? Because it's different for every kind of thing that you're doing.
Right, right. That's what I was wondering about. It's like, say your product's a shoe, right? You have everybody wear the shoes. You know what I mean? I mean, say your product is a medical device. Do you have everybody? How do the folks who you've invited to a brain trust style kind of objective feedback session acquire the requisite context and immersion in the work in progress so that they can provide valuable feedback on it?
Yes. But the way I would frame it is, that's your question. That's your problem. So if you believe that's an important thing to do,
that's what you're orienting around. Yeah, I see.
Yes. Yeah. So now you keep trying to figure out how to do that. If it isn't, let's change what we're doing.
And that's the meta role that you said that you were holding, right? Is you're attending to, does this group have sufficient context to be able to weigh in objectively? I see.
And that was one of the points of the expanded one, is that what the brain trust is not what it started off to be. And its goal to begin with was one that it couldn't do. So it changed and it kept changing and it kept evolving over all those years. It's never been exactly the same thing. The personalities are different. The people are different.
And even it sounds like even the objective is different, and the way and the means by which you accomplish the objective is different.
Right. It isn't a stable thing.
That's like, great.
There's nothing stable in this picture.
That's great. Well, you talk later about when you got acquired, the Pixar people are going, thought you said things would never change. I mean, to me, what I took from that section of the book is you go, no. The norm here is change. Don't attribute all the changes to the acquisition. And I think brain trust is actually a fantastic portrait of that. It's what you said is so, so valuable. It's not static. I want to switch gears and I want to talk about blue-footed newts. Okay. This is something that you referred to as the incubator project. And the reason that I was drawn to this, the reason I want to kind of dig into it a little bit is we hear in the innovation space, we hear a lot about kind of call it skunk works types setups where with separate spaces and the value of such separation, et cetera. Why did the incubator project not work in your experience?
Well, the first thing to note is that we had several projects that didn't work. And we would always try to do things to have them change. And typically, we would, if they really couldn't work, and you go at a lot of time, but you have to. And if they can't fix it, then we'll, after trying a lot of things, we'll make a change. And often, it means we will change directors. So another example would be Ratatouille. So Ratatouille is a wonderful man, designed it. In fact, the concept of the film came from him, the design of the film, the look. This was actually fairly well along, and it wasn't working. And at this point, we brought in Brad Bird to then take the film, and he solved two big problems that were actually holding it back. In other words, the tentpole things that were screwing up the films, he solved. And if you looked at the final film, while everything was rewritten about it, the basic concept was the one that originally came from that first director.
But the original, what you're saying is the original concept and even vision is insufficient to result in an exceptional output. And while the vision was there, Brad's perspective was required to turn it in, as you say, take it from suck to not suck, which I really liked.
Yeah. So that's what happened in that case. So we had other ones that were like that, like somebody else came in, they solved the problems because these are hard problems. So in this case, again, wonderful man, a challenging concept. Just they had real problems trying to get it all to work. So we did change directors. We brought in Pete Docter and we asked Pete to do it.
And this, when we say it, now we're just for the audience's sake, we're now referring to the Blue-Footed Newt project.
That's right.
Okay. Yeah. Why did you call it, by the way, just as an aside, in case it may be helpful context, why did you refer to it as the incubator project? What was unique about the setup or structure that justified a naming designation?
Yeah. In truth, I don't even remember. I mean, sometimes we'll try different things and I'll forget why we did them.
I love it.
It was just, you know, we put them in a different building to let them try different things. But in the end, it was like the others, like, because every one of them, we try something different. We're trying to solve the problem in different ways.
But so you get Pete Docter involved in the Blue-Footed Newt project. It's set up a little bit differently. What happens? And why do you look back and say, we shouldn't do films like that next time? What did you take away from that experience that shaped how you moved forward with the next films?
You know, what I took away is that is what we do. And if we're going to do these ideas that are unusual, then every once in a while, something like this will happen. In fact, that's the only film we didn't complete, because if anything, I know what makes something work is getting the right people behind it to solve the problems. It's a little less about making the risky ideas because they're all hard. And then it's getting everything to work. And we get near the edge at times. And I'm surprised we completed as many as we did. So there wasn't anything about this one which says, oh, we should do it different. Not at all. Mm. It's like that was the consequence of taking a risk.
Right.
And we put Pete over it. But what Pete said was, well, basically, since I'm pretty much starting from scratch, I have another idea which I think would be better and more passionate about. And this would take place inside the head of a little girl. So as soon as he said that, the general reaction was, yeah, that sounded like a pretty good idea. And our films are driven by how strongly people feel about something. And if he's passionate about doing that, then that's the most valuable asset that any group can have.
Maybe this is a good segue. I was actually going to talk about this later, but it's kind of fitting now. So I'm switching my notes. Let's talk about the three pitches rule for a second, because that's an innovative mechanism. I'd love for you to explain where that comes from. And then as it relates to Pete's decision to push pause on the Blue-Footed Newt project and start thinking about a story in this little girl's head and your comments about where folks' passion is. Talk about for a second, what's the three pitches rule? And then what I want to get to is, how do you know which of the three pitches to select?
There are a couple of things here. In fact, it's not a law there, because there's some people who don't work that way, and that's fine. The basic notion is, if we pick someone because we think they can be a director or they have directed, and we know that when they develop something that they can get stuck. We've all been there, right? You're trying to, even doing your homework back in school, right? You get stuck. And so you start to bang your head against the wall because you need to do it. And if you pick an idea and you're trying to solve the problems, you do get stuck. They're starting at an early point and they don't even know exactly what the ideas they want to make. What I ask is they come up with three pitches. The reason for that is that if they get stuck, they switch to one of the other ideas. So over the course of a year, they're switching back and forth between these three ideas. They've got maybe one or two people helping them, plus the development department providing some resources for them.
Okay.
But the idea, like, is this is really one, two, you know, three people, but it's really the director coming up with these three ideas. And at the end of the year, they're going to pitch what they've come up with.
Right. And they're going to showcase, these are my three pitches of the next film I could direct.
Yes. And so at this point, they're now going to show them to the other creative people in the company.
Okay.
I should note that as creative people, they've been in these in the past, so they kind of know how it works.
Okay.
And they've watched how they work in the past. But now, even though that's true, the following things happen. Roughly what happens is that when they pitch their ideas, they start off by saying, I love all three ideas equally, and it doesn't matter to me which one you pick.
Okay. How many ideas have you tested today? How about your team or organization? IdeaFlow is a set of tools that help you test more ideas faster. I've worked with both high-growth startups and global organizations, and success comes when you test more ideas faster. Want to learn how better IdeaFlow can help your organization? Check out my website, jeremyutley.design, or reach out to me at jutley@jeremyutley.design. I'd love to talk with you.
And do you have reason to disbelieve that statement? Is that what you're insinuating?
And we all know it's not true, that they really do prefer one of these ideas, sometimes very strongly.
Okay.
But you can also understand why they would say that, because you're putting yourself out in front of people, and you're vulnerable. You have to acknowledge people's vulnerability in any position they're in. In this case, they've got a setup, and typically we have two story rooms. The story room's can hold about 12 people in it. There's a table in the middle, two long walls. So one wall will have the artwork for one idea, the other wall, the artwork for the other idea, and then we go to an adjacent room for
the third wall. Okay.
So with each one, they present them, and it's about a half hour per story and so forth. So my favorite one was Coco.
Yeah.
Where Lee Unkrich presented his three ideas. The first two were quite reasonable. We had a good discussion, and then we moved over into the third room.
Well, and if not to interrupt, but if I remember correctly, the first two had kind of been in development and kind of kicking around in people's minds for a while. So there was a sense of these are both great options, right? That was my recollection.
Yeah, the first one was the one that had been in development in the past. The second one was he wanted to do a musical. So this was the first Pixar musical. At Disney, music's in the DNA of the company.
Right.
This is not true at Pixar. That is musicals with 5 to 7 numbers. Obviously, music.
So that second idea was a bold new direction for Pixar, you're saying?
Yeah, it was a whole new direction, and it looked really interesting.
So you got these two, and then you go in the third room. Now, what happened?
We walk in the third room. We open the door. The ceiling, the table, both walls, and the end wall are covered with Mexican artwork.
So, your typical setup for a three pitches presentation, right?
That's right. So at that moment, you walk into the room and every single person in that room knows which movie that we're going to make. Now, the other interesting thing is he wanted to be a musical. And the other one, which we knew was the case, was that the final movie that came out actually bore little resemblance to that original pitch.
Interesting.
But the thing was, we all know that's the case. What we want is that they care about the idea.
It's almost like they have to have the energy, the fuel in the tank to endure all of the necessary pivots and iterations that are going to be required to bring a film to fruition.
Yeah, it's going to change. How could it not change? And one of the things was it ended up not being musical, and the people that wrote the music for that very great song, which is Remember Me, they did that as part of the musical. But that then became the pivotal single song that drove the emotion of the movie, which is very powerful at the end of the movie.
Wow.
So, okay. What do you predict? I don't predict.
I love that. I love that as an example of preserving director passion and honoring that which is required to ultimately deliver creative work. I want to shift slightly now. And you talk about this notion of protecting new ideas. And the importance of protection, and you define protection a little bit differently than maybe some do. I want to talk about Finding Nemo for a second and start with, you said that we had this goal with Finding Nemo because production costs are enormously high. If you're finalizing the story while you're producing, you had a goal that you said was worthy, but totally naive, of finalizing the story before you got in production. So in this spirit of, in connection to this idea of protecting new ideas, I'd love to hear from you briefly. Why was that a worthy goal? And then why was it naive to think that you could achieve it?
Well, if you were to walk into any production, it's clear that when you make changes, your costs go up. If a movie is going to change because you are altering it while you're making it, then everything you put into it now has to be sort of rethought and reworked. Wow. And it doesn't take much to say, look at this and say, that's the reason the movies cost a lot of money. You keep changing it. Quit changing the damn thing.
Change, just lock it, and then we can just produce it, and it will be done.
You know, write the script and make your decisions based upon the script. And if you get that script right the first time, then it will be a lot cheaper to make.
Right. By the way, I'm a recovering MBA, and you're deeply appealing to my need for, you know, the ability to predict a budget. So thank you.
Yes. And that is, it's very clear to me that anybody that would come in with a nice MBA would look at that and say, duh.
Right. This is a clear area of innovation. Just finish the story first, you dummies.
Yeah. So in fact, we do write it first, and then we start to make it, and then we change the damn thing.
And why? Why change it after you start making it? What's going on there?
What we wanted to do was to figure out, okay, how do we get it right to begin with? So then Andrew pitched Finding Nemo, and it was a brilliant presentation. It was sophisticated. It had lots of opportunity for humor, great filmmaking, wonderful pitch. Anybody that watched it said, okay, we're going to make that film.
Right.
So then we start to make it, and certain things aren't working about it. We didn't have the sympathy for the father. The comedy of it wasn't working. It was confusing.
And this is stuff, I suppose what you're getting at is stuff that you couldn't a priori know. You thought, I'm sure, when you crafted the story, that sufficient sympathy is there for the father, right? But it's almost as it's coming into production that you realize, whoa, something's, it's only in making it that you realize what needs to be rewritten. Is that right?
Yes. Because the pitch is somebody talking to a group of people who are themselves filmmakers. And Andrew, who is one of the best people at pitching that I've ever seen, is performing in front of an audience while he's looking them in the face.
Mm. Filling in the gaps. Everybody's mental model is slightly different. And therefore, we all agree to some vague thing, which we say is fixed, but really is not.
Well, and the thing was, is that when you actually start to put it up, it's at that time when you feel like, okay, there's something wrong with the voice of the father doesn't quite work. And also, we don't know why he's so overprotective because we don't find out until the end of the film.
Oh, in the original conceiving of the film.
Yes, because you remember at the first of the film, there was that barracuda that came in, sort of wiped out the nest.
Oh, yeah.
And we don't find that out until the end of the film in the pitch. Wow. But what it means is we don't really like the father through most of the movie because he's overprotective. It's kind of an annoying overprotective. If you move that barracuda scene up at the beginning, then you really understand and empathize with the father. Okay, so you don't know that.
No way to know that ahead of time.
So yeah. when you actually see it, you say, okay, we need to do this. So when you actually put these things together and you've got them up in front of other people and you start to put them on storyboards, because we basically make a cartoon version of the films ahead of time and then get them up with the music and with either with actors or with people who are, you know, speaking the parts, like inside actors, will be filled in later with the real actors. But there are some concepts that actually did work quite well from the beginning.
Well, to me, one just kind of pragmatic takeaway for leaders, perhaps in other spaces, is clear, which is there's no way to know how something's going to work until you start to do it, right? We talk at the DCYC, Diego just dropped this line in the chat, building to think rather than thinking before you build is actually building in order to inform your thinking. And I think the MBA, kind of the budget and spreadsheet says, wow, this is a way better way to do it. We can cut a lot of costs if we do it. But ultimately what you get at, and what you said so eloquently in the book, is ultimately if cost is the primary consideration, it subverts your ultimate goal. Your ultimate goal isn't saving costs. Your ultimate goal is making a spectacular film. And it's easy, kind of in the cold calculus of the spreadsheet, to say, oh, let's do it this way. But if you don't have that flexibility and you aren't willing to actually change what you're learning or how you're thinking based on what you've built, then you end up delivering a suboptimal product. Is that a fair summation of what you learned there?
Yes. And, you know, I think the building to think actually does capture, because it's saying, okay, we're doing something, but we're going to learn in the process. We always want to learn. Our whole process should be one about informing and getting it to be better, figuring out why we're having problems, because it may be, in fact, it's frequently the case that we will not make the same mistake again, but we will make other ones.
Right, right. We shouldn't assume we're not going to make any more mistakes.
Yes, but we are learning. So we're examining each one of these things and say, okay, can we actually learn from that? It was actually one of the great lessons I got. This is after I graduated from Utah, and I was then over a group. My experience at Utah when I was a graduate student working on my PhD was profound. I mean, this is a wonderful environment. It set the course of my life. And I came out thinking, this is the kind of environment I want to have wherever I go.
Recreate it, yeah.
So I tried to set it up. No, I knew I wasn't in a university, so I wasn't that dumb, but but it was a research environment. So I tried to set up these things, and some of the things were very successful. That's what led to basically George Lucas coming to hire me to run his group at Lucasfilm. But as I left to go to Lucasfilm, I could look back on the things I had tried, and some of the things were successful, and about a half the ideas were a crock. But for me, the most important thing that I came away with was, at the time I thought, I'm going to come up with new ideas for the future, but I bet that my ratio of right to wrong will be about the same. 50.
Wow. What a humble way to think about it. It's easy to think, okay, all my failures in the past, now every idea I have moving forward, 100% success rate. So what were the implications there? Just to kind of continue on the line of thought, if you say, I assume 50% of the great ideas I've had now moving forward are still going to fail, what are the implications on that, on the structure that you create there?
Because I believe that going forward, that about, you know, half the new things in the future that would not work, and that ratio would continue for the rest of my life. Unfortunately, it turns out to be true, or fortunately.
Yeah, I think it's a wonderful thing, right? It's like Moore's Law. It will continue to get half the things right.
Yeah, so the important thing for me was to realize that I was going to be wrong more than I thought I was. And of course, you can't really measure what the number is, but it's that thing that I found very useful. So as we work on every new film, we're going to try new things every time. We're always going to do it.
And some proportion's not going to work.
Some will not work. There are also things that work, but in the future, they won't even be appropriate anymore.
Because of technological advances or otherwise. Yeah.
Yeah. Or the people are different. There are all sorts of things that change.
Okay. Actually, I want to get to people here. We have a mutual friend, RC Buford, who's the CEO of the San Antonio Spurs. And he was telling me, or he asked me to ask this question, which I thought was great, around recruiting and people management. He said, can creativity be measured and or assessed in the selection process and in the people management assessment systems?
Well, first of all, I think that most people have got the ability to be additive, that the real issue is that the managers are the main block to creative solutions.
Okay.
Like the title of the book is like, what are the unseen forces? Well, it turns out the managers are the unseen force.
Okay. Don't give away the ending. That's my last question, because that's my, as you know, my primary obsession. But RC asked, can creativity be assessed? The first thing you said was most people have the ability to be additive, but managers block. So, okay, continue with the people management thread there. It stands, you're saying most people can contribute additively, creatively. What does it look like? How do you think about assessing creativity once somebody's in? Are they being additive or not? Please continue.
Well, as we've hired, and I found this in general, is that there are some people who are extremely good and their companies dearly value them. So they're not readily available. There are people who are very experienced, but they're not strongly attached. So sometimes the experienced people are not the ones to get, because if they're really good, their companies would hang on to them. So I don't say the most important thing is experience. Now, I don't want to overgeneralize, because sometimes you actually get somebody that's demonstrably good and you really want them, or they come because they really want to be with you. So what I'm looking more for is, what's their arc? What I've found is frequently if you get somebody, even if they don't have much experience, but they're on an upward arc, then they're likely to be good.
And what's on the axis, not to get too nerdy here for a second, but if you think about an arc, what are you attuned to? What are you paying attention to that's kind of mapping that curve?
Well, in the case of, here's something we did at Pixar. This is early on, where for Bug's Life, which is our second film, they went out and they tried to hire experienced people from other places. And I couldn't convince them to do otherwise. I, first of all, I don't try to over control. But we actually have the highest percentage of people who are let go after a film.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Because frankly, they're mediocre based upon what they drew from. So, and the other one was once they had made their first film, then people tend to think that they wanted to hire people like they were. But in fact, when they came to the company for Toy Story, they had never done it before.
Right. Why in the world? They misattribute reasons for success, et cetera.
Yes. Now, I mean, they've learned since then. But I also wanted them to put in a program for interns. What I found to begin with was nobody wanted to get interns. Well, what they said was they didn't want the interns was because they didn't want to babysit while they're doing their production.
Right. And they wanted to protect their budgets, right? I mean, they don't want to be funding their own babysitting.
Yes. So, but it turns out the budget was actually the real issue. More important than what they thought of babysitting, which is a stupid answer in any case. But once I realized the real issue was their budget, then we just made it a company expense. So they didn't have to pay for it.
How did you identify that the real issue was budget, by the way? Because that's a non-trivial reframe, right? If you're trying to solve the problem of perceived babysitting, that's one thing. If you're trying to solve the problem of we don't have the budget, it's totally different. How did you discern the distinction there?
Well, it was a comment made in some meeting about the cost of it. It was a side comment, which is usually how you figure things out, right? Yeah. You're always looking for clues.
Yeah.
I'm a big believer in clues. Both in terms of looking at them as well as giving them. So in this case, it was one of those comments that was made from which I deduced that the real issue was paying for it. I then went back to them and said, we're going to pay for the interns, only to learn that they immediately said, okay, good idea.
It's amazing how fast something goes from being a bad idea to a good idea when you don't have to pay for it.
Yeah, so it was more like a confirmation. My presumption that was the real issue there. So that first year, we brought in 8 interns from different schools on the film. But the thing that happened right away, and this is because of the needs of the film, is that they were taught to use the tools and they actually did work on a film. So they weren't babysitting, they were doing production work.
Right, right.
Which was cool to them. And then they went back to school because these essentially were juniors and they had 1 year of school left. And our issue with all of them is we wanted to make sure they all finished their schooling. So we weren't trying to steal them away, even though they had done really good work. Now they go back to school and they're coming from different schools. They said, we got to do production work on this film that came out.
Incredible.
Like Nemo or something like that. Yeah. And so next year, a lot of their classmates applied for the interns.
That's where we can do real work, right? We're not being given grunt work. It's the greatest sales pitch for an internship.
Yeah. So of those first 8 people, 7 came back later to become full-time hires at the company.
Incredible.
So you think about the gain. One of them is that what I found is that taking a risk on people that look like they've got the right intentions is not high risk. You just assume they're going to do good work. And this is very important to me. It's that people don't have to earn your trust. We actually start off, we give them our trust. And there are people who actually may not do well. And so, all right, that's an issue. But I would say the general case is that the trust that we've given them was worth giving them.
Yeah.
The second thing is that they're coming as an intern. Well, we get to know them. I'm spending 3 to 6 months with them. So we actually know who they are. So when it comes time to having them come back, well, we've already been exposed to them. So
right. Your data, it's much less of a blind selection problem. Okay. So I want to get to a rapid fire lightning round. I'm mindful of time, but there's a few questions I'm dying to ask. So let's just see if we can do them quickly. And if you want to expound, I mean, you have the mic and the stage, you can expound as long as possible, but I want to just
be careful because I have 50 years of rabbit holes to go down.
And anybody who knows me well, most of this audience knows I love nothing more than a good rabbit trail. So we may be in trouble. Folks, buckle in. We're not near done. Okay. So first thing, rapid fire lightning round, the hidden. I am obsessed with assumptions because I find, by the way, that many times identifying the assumption or the wrong assumption is actually the breakthrough. Okay. You talk about this in the hidden. My question for you is, do you have tactics for identifying assumptions?
Oh, well, the first one is is to start off with the notion that I'm actually missing something. I'm always missing something. So I'm looking for clues. And my tactic is to look for the clues, and that if I do get a clue, it doesn't mean I'm right, but it's worth digging further.
Just digging on that, I love that. When you said you're mindful that you're missing something, when do you need to remind yourself of that? Like what triggers the thought, I'm missing something? Because I would assume you aren't just walking around all the time in every part of your life saying, I'm missing something. What reminds you to that, oh yeah, I'm probably missing something? What happens before that?
Typically, I do try to set up something where I walk around, I talk with people, and on a weekly basis, I try to have a random lunch with people.
Okay.
And part of that is that I want to give a signal of availability, but the other one is I'm just listening for signals or cues. Are people hesitant? Or if they come in my office to raise an issue, then how do they do it? How do they approach it? How do they raise
it? Right. That's great. Yeah, the great Bill Baker, I don't know if you know this, but at Bell Labs, he was known to eat lunch with a different person. They said sometimes he'd eat with the janitor. And by the end of lunch, they said he would know everything there was to know about janitorial at Bell Labs, because he just saw his lunch as a time to really learn. So I love that. Okay, next question for you. Not that we could go. And by the way, if you want to go back to the rabbit trail, I'm not going to say no. There's an old adage, hindsight is 20/20. Your thoughts?
A complete nonsense. It's our view of what takes place in the past is no better than our view of the future. Is we're so blind to the things that help make us what we are, that we draw these incorrect conclusions about how we got where we are. And just as when we look off in the future, like we can see, well, it's a little fuzzy beyond a certain point. It's the same looking backwards. So it just isn't true.
And what are the implications, knowing that hindsight is not 20/20? How does that shape your worldview, your path forward, et cetera? Because that to me is a really powerful, the thought that hindsight 2020 is complete nonsense is incredibly powerful. How do you operationalize that in your day-to-day?
Well, you have learned something in the past, but the 2020 notion is that you have a clear view of it. You don't. You have a coarse view of it. So if you look forward in the future, then the question is, what kind of assumptions do you make about what's going to happen? And there's certain things where our intuition about the future are completely lacking, like exponential change, which we're going through and have been for some time, is not intuitive at all to us. But there are tools that we can have to make decisions about the future. But looking back, if we think we've got a clear view, then we can basically think we're geniuses when we're lucky, when in fact we were just lucky.
Right. Well, it reminds me of maybe one thing I hadn't thought of this when I was reading the book, but one thing could be we often postmortem failures because we want to understand failures, but then postmorteming success and just asking the question, what is the randomness to which we are attributed? What is the luck to which we attribute our competence is probably a useful retroactive to inform or at least correct our cloudy vision of the past.
Yeah. And that's a tricky one. Because over and over again, it's a big problem. If a company is successful, typically the leaders will think it's because they are geniuses, and it screws their heads up. Very serious problem is that the success actually is one of the things that's most likely to damage a company, and they're less likely to listen. If you fail or your company is stressed, you're more likely to listen to alternate ways of doing things. But if you're successful, it's because you're really good. And so you don't need to listen to others.
I don't need to listen. Did you see our last quarter's performance? We don't need to listen. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Next rapid fire question. Research trips. What are they? How do you use them? When do you need them?
Well, in the context of the movie, because research means different things to different people. In this case is we are telling stories, but it's fairly easy to base stories on our assumptions, our prejudices, or things that we know. And the whole purpose of getting into the outside world is to find out things that we didn't know.
Stuff we hadn't seen before. Give the example of Monsters University. I thought that was a great kind of example of that.
Well, in the case of Monsters University, it was, okay, let's go into the dorm rooms. Let's go to universities. Even though people have been to school, if you think about it, most people have only had the experience of one or two schools they've been to.
Right.
Let's see what it's like a lot of places. In the case of Finding Nemo, so here's one that people might think is a little odd, but one of the story points is the fish goes into the dental drain and it goes down through the sewage system into the ocean. So the question is, could a fish really do that?
So, wait, I thought we had to suspend disbelief here, Ed. Come on.
we do at times, but sometimes you actually need something. So we went for a tour of the San Francisco sewage treatment plant to find out whether or not a fish could make it through the treatment plant.
Wow.
The answer is it can. But in the case of Ratatouille, we went into the best restaurants in Paris. Some research trips are easier than others.
I was going to say, that must have been really hard for the team.
That was hard for the team. But they went into the kitchens. It's like, what's the culture like? Because it turns out the culture in the kitchens isn't the same thing that you see on the cooking channel or you see in your house when you cook. Now, the interesting thing to me that we found in these research trips is we're finding things that we didn't know, but the audience doesn't know either because they haven't been in these kitchens.
Or they haven't been looking like that, right? Yeah.
The thing is, if you put those elements in the film, even if the audience doesn't know if it's true, they sense that it is. And that's what you want. But I think that's true with products there. It's like, do we assume we know what the customers want? Or do we go out and check? Do we find out? Do we talk to people?
Right. Reminds me, it's a little bit analogous, but it reminds me of one of my favorite stories about Steve Jobs when he was frustrated with one of the original designs of the Mac. He got up and went to Macy's in Palo Alto, just down the street here. And he was kind of haunting the aisles, going back and forth through Macy's, just looking. And he stumbles on a Cuisinart food processor. And he picks it up, he buys it, he brings it back to the team. And he says, it's supposed to look like this. You know, it's like, and to me, that's one, you go, wait, why is a computer supposed to look like that? But two, the point is, when you're stuck, get out of the office. And what you're saying is even further, even when you think you're not stuck, get out of the office, right?
Yes. Get out and find out something you didn't know.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful. That could be the bumper sticker over this whole thing. Find out something you didn't know. I have two rapid fire questions left. You told me when we spoke the other day that you get two questions by a wide margin at the end of your talks. One is your favorite movie, which we don't need to go into that. It's like picking a favorite child, I'm sure. But the other, you said, what do I do if my boss doesn't understand this? Well, how do you answer that question? I get, Ed, what you're saying here, and I have absorbed these principles, but my boss, how do you respond to that?
The one thing, because it's always a hard question to answer, is that they should never forget that they asked this question.
Mm-hmm.
And because they do have some autonomy and control of how they treat people.
Yeah.
Because sometimes their boss is not going to listen. I know that. We all know that.
Yeah.
But we need to have people say, okay, I'm going to learn from this. And the way I treat people and the way I encourage people is very important. It should be a value that we have.
Yeah. It's a beautiful answer. I love that. Just to kind of put a fine point on it. Never forget that you asked that question. Because at some point, you're going to be the person who is the boss, who needs to remember these things. Okay, this kind of gets to the subtitle. Here's where I want it to end. Your subtitle for your book is Overcoming the Unseen Forces That Stand in the Way of True Inspiration. And for me, you and I spoke about this a little bit, but it reminded me of what Danny Kahneman says about restraining forces, that the much more elegant way of achieving behavior change isn't providing motivation, it's actually removing restraint. You talk about overcoming the forces that stand in the way. First of all, maybe there's two parts to this question. First part, you said managers are oftentimes, individuals can be additive, but managers stand in the way. What do you do about that? If the managers, maybe middle management, is what's standing in the way of true inspiration, what do you do about that?
Well, it was one of the things that drew me to begin with was that when I was at Lucasfilm and I was visiting a lot of companies because I was in this enviable position of the leaders of the companies would want to talk with me because they want to sell to Lucasfilm.
Right, right.
A sexy company. And the engineers wanted to talk because I had a technical background. So, first of all, notice there's this cultural difference. But just as importantly, the leaders of these companies were making some really dumb decisions. And it was this bizarre thing that for me was, why is it the leaders over technical companies were actually not paying attention to what was taking place inside their own industry? Why were they so blind to this? Why is it that if you look at the workstation companies, that none of them survived until today? Was this inevitable?
Wow.
And it's clear to me it was not inevitable. but in fact, that the leaders actually were stuck on their business models and weren't even open to figuring out how to adapt to something that was going to happen in the future. And that was a blindness. It was in the way. That was something that they couldn't see. And the question was, why couldn't they see it? And how does one overcome that? The person that I saw who was frankly best at that was Steve Jobs. He could imagine how things might need to be different, which would be a very different business model. So selling phones, for instance, is a very different business model than selling laptops. But most people couldn't do that.
Do you think there's anything to, like, why was it that Steve was able to imagine how things might need to be different? What was it about him?
For me, what happened was that he did learn. He started off with a behavior that was well known, and that's when I first knew him, and I witnessed that. But he was also very smart, and he learned from his mistakes, and he made some serious mistakes. He made some design mistakes with his hardware. He made some business mistakes with, I'm talking about Next Computer. But the thing about mistakes was he learned from the mistakes, but he also made a brilliant decision regarding the software. And that software was the sole reason that years later, Apple bought Next, was to get that software. Now, so what was happening to Steve over this period of time? Because he was going through essentially the hero's journey.
Right.
Like, you know, this screwed up, that didn't work. And the first version of Pixar didn't work. I mean, it's just a frigging disaster, but he's just learning. In the years of 91 to 95, he went through a profound transformation. By the end of this period, the people who were with him stayed with him for the rest of his life. Part of that was, which is a thing that people don't get, was that he was arguing about the problem, and not, it wasn't about him being right. It was about getting to the right solution.
Wow.
So it meant having people who knew how to disagree with him, but he valued they disagree with he valued the fact they disagreed with him. In fact, at Pixar, because we were a public company for 10 years, he fired two members of the board of directors because they never disagreed.
That's awesome.
And he just said, it isn't any good if we have people who disagree with me.
Yeah.
So what's the mindset that got him there? And one of them was, okay, this really is about getting the product right. It's not about being right.
Right.
Because the people who disagree with him, frankly, sometimes they're right and he'd accept it. And sometimes he would say, no, this is where we have to go. And then he realized later that they were right. But the point was, he had the disagreements inside the company.
Yeah, that's so good. I mean, we recently we had Ron Johnson on the show, who was Steve's head of retail at Apple. And he told these stories about how he said sometimes they would get in the car and they'd drive to the store. And he said, I remember one time, Greg McEwen, who's a friend of mine, an author, an amazing thought leader, he and I did this joint interview with Ron. And we asked him, hey, what are five key moments in your relationship with Steve Jobs? And one of the moments he described was having to give some very direct feedback about how fundamentally they needed to reorient the store around a new strategy that was emerging, right? Similar, actually, kind of to the Zootopia, maybe coming full circle. It's like, this thing's in production and we're realizing Nick shouldn't be the main character. And we're realizing the collar scene isn't right. I mean, the entire layout of the store was wrong. And Ron said he told Steve when he got in the car and they drove to the store. And Steve didn't say a word. He said, I knew that he was not happy. And he said, we get out of the car and he walks into the store. And he said, so Ron tells me that all of this is wrong. Ask him what you need to do to fix it. And he got back in the car and drove away. And it's just a great example to me of it's the disagreement is painful at times. And Ron said, you know, usually they're talking in the car the whole time. So it's very weird for it to be silent the whole time. But he said, it's clear he's taking the disagreement seriously and he values the input so much so that by the time they get to the store, he's already changed his mind, which I think is just a really incredible example. The other thing I want to just circle back to as we kind of wrap up here is this comment that you made about inevitability. To me, it seems when we think about the subtitle, Overcoming the Unseen Forces That Stand in the Way of Inspiration, it seems that there are some folks who just don't want things to change. That's part of what I'm taking from what you said. And even your attitude of, I'm going to continue to be wrong 50% of the time. There's something there that I really feel is an important mindset that change is inevitable and allowing yourself to entertain the prospect of how is the inevitable going to unfold is probably a much safer way to approach the future than assuming things are going to remain this. I mean, to say, state the obvious. I wanted to give you that word, inevitability of change, and see if that resonated with you or if you have any thoughts again about the unseen forces that hinder inspiration.
For me, one of the important things to understand, which is for me, it was an important realization, was that if we look at whatever we're doing, even like we're in a sweet spot, we've kind of got things going well, that the underlying technology continues to change. The understanding that people coming in to use our tools or to make what we're making continues to change. The expectations of the customers change. There is nothing in this picture that is stable. The concept that we're going to hit some sweet spot, like a stable point, is a complete illusion. It doesn't work that way. There isn't anything that's stable. It's like, okay, it is the way things are. I get that. So our job is to continually adapt, not to reach stability. It's to solve the problems that we have now, and figure them out. And that process will keep on going. It's okay.
Yeah. Yeah. It's almost like the metaphor you and I talked about the other day is the idea of the bicycle. Is balance is only achieved by movement. If you stop moving, you lose the balance and you fall over.
Yeah. So if you say, okay, you have to move to stay balanced, but also your view keeps changing. So the purpose of bicycle is to move. So it isn't just to stay where you are and stay balanced because it happens to be nice. It's not the purpose.
The point is the movement. That's beautiful. I can't think of a better way to wrap. I mean, Ed, we could, as I think you and I both know, we could go off on another 1,000 tangents. Perhaps maybe we call it a day here. We could get audience feedback and maybe we do a part 2 at some time. But I just want to say thank you so much putting this work into the world. I know many people, our mutual friend Bob Sutton included, who say, this is the best book on management and creativity I've ever read. And I can't recommend your book highly enough. I love the expanded edition. I love what you've done with it. I tremendously am grateful for you making the time to join us today.
I really appreciate being with you, Jeremy.
Yeah, thanks so much. I hope folks had a great time. Give us your feedback. Let us know in the comments what you thought of today's conversation. Next week, I'll be talking with Jennifer Wallace, who's the author of Never Enough, which is talking a bit concerned with achievement culture among youth and parents. It's a very important topic, one that as a father of four, I'm really excited to dive into. So I hope you'll join us next week. Until then, thanks so much. You can find the recording here and then we'll post it to podcast platforms later. Have a great day. By day, I'm a professor, but I absolutely love moonlighting as a front row student next to you during these interviews. One of my favorite things is taking the gems from these episodes and turning them into practical tips and lessons for you and your team. If you want to share the lessons you picked up from this episode with your organization, feel free to reach out. I'd be thrilled to do a keynote on the secrets that I've gleaned from creative masters or put together a hands-on workshop to supercharge your next offsite adventure. Hit me up at jutley@jeremyutley.design for more information.